all my friends out there in Drive Time Land. It's me, your friend, Pastor Craig D'Onofrio. Good to be with you today. I hope everything's going well with you wherever you are. If you're listening live or on the podcast or via the archives. By the way, you can listen to this program and so many others at KFUO.org. Go to the archives and check out what we have there. All sorts of good stuff there. We're underwritten by ConcordiaHistoricalInstitute.org. Go discover your Lutheran history. All sorts of really, really cool historical things over there. If you have anyone in your family or you just want to know the history of your church or anything that goes back to, back to the 1830s, they even have first edition Books of Concord. Is that how you say it, plural? Book of Concords? Books of Concord. And all sorts of really, really amazing stuff. Check them out, ConcordiaHistoricalInstitute.org. Also, be my friend on Facebook, Craig D'Onofrio, D-O-N-O-F-R-I-O, or this program, Reformation Rush Hour, and, of course, like KFUO Radio. You can check out my blog, 200proofgospel.com, and let's see, Twitter, at Craig_D'Onofrio. I think that's about all of the outlets. I need to get on a Pinterest and a few others, but, you know, that's for the kids. I don't know. I'm just using that as an excuse. Anyway, we've got a really, really exciting day. I am excited about this because here's a guy who has done a lot of research on my background. He has done his doctoral dissertation, basically, on evangelicals who have become Lutherans. And, of course, I do a segment on this program called Lutheran on Purpose. The Reverend Dr. Matthew Richard from Zion Lutheran Church, not Gwinner Lutheran Church, Zion Lutheran Church in Gwinner, North Dakota. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Craig. It's good to be here.
Hey, you're there. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Hey, before we jump into this, I always like to give our guests an opportunity to plug their church and that sort of thing. Anything new and exciting going on at your church, or did you have a great Easter?
Yeah, very busy Easter. I'm actually serving the church here in Gwinner, Zion Lutheran, and also a vacancy pastor down at St. John's Lutheran Church in Oak. So it was a really busy time going back and forth between two churches. And so literally it was, getting done with a Good Friday service and leaving the vestments on, hopping in my car with my full vestments on, and, you know, driving 25 miles down the road, getting out of the car and walking right in and starting off with the invocation, and there we go. It was crazy, but it was great. So
you remind me, my first call out of seminary, I ended up serving two congregations, one in Connecticut and one in Rhode Island. And there were very many Sundays where I would do that also, driving between the two. And I got pulled over by a cop one day. And Rhode Island is heavily Roman Catholic. And the cop looked at me and he said, "Well, Father, I'd give you a ticket, but I'm afraid I'd go to hell."
So that's great. That's great. Yeah, so it was wonderful, wonderful Easter with the saints here in Gwinner and also in Oaks. And so we're just wrapping that season up and getting excited for the church down in Oaks, North Dakota. They're getting their new pastor come May, and so I'm excited to see that transition happen for them. So it's just wonderful. Good stuff.
Are they getting a young guy fresh out of the seminary?
No, actually, they're getting Pastor Jonathan Fisk from World the Everlasting.
Yes.
So Pastor Fisk will be coming up here probably in 2 or 3 weeks. So, they're really blessed to have him, and he'll be blessed to have them as a church. So
I knew he was heading your way, but I didn't know that it was that congregation. Well, they're very fortunate to have Jonathan.
It'll be nice to have him as a neighbor, too. So
you bet. So, anyway, today we're talking about something that you've become a local expert on. And you wrote your doctoral dissertation on this, and I actually printed out all 180-something pages, and it's sitting on my desk, and I was thumbing through it. And I've got to say, you've really done a lot of really interesting work on this. But it's about evangelical Christians becoming Lutheran. What kind of tickled your fancy on this? Why did this become your thing?
Well, part of it is it's sorting through my journey. I kind of always say that I'm kind of a spiritual mutt. You know, growing up, my father was Roman Catholic for 72 years, and he's actually part of the LCMS now, but I went to a little bit of the Roman Catholic Church growing up, and my background, too, was in a church denomination that was influenced by what we would call Lutheran Pietism, And also the revivals, the revivalism. And then, boy, later on, I would say in college, my wife was assistant manager at a Christian bookstore, so we got really plugged into evangelicalism and the Christian rock concerts and the Christian contemporary music and Promise Keepers and all the rest. And so I had this, you know, basically, I like to use this illustration of a theological house. And so I had all these different theological traditions within this house. And I was trying to house all of them together. And long story short, the different theological camps or different theological personalities in this house, they started to collapse and fight. You know, they didn't get along. And so my theological house came tumbling down. And in the midst of the rubble, trying to make sense of everything, I started drifting towards Lutheranism, and confessional Lutheranism as expressed in the Book of Concord, and made a transition to colloquize into the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. So it was really kind of my own journey of sorting these things through. And then with the doctoral theses, they wanted you to pick a subject that was kind of relevant to your context and something that really sparked your interest. And so I said to myself, hey, I want to study this transition. What actually occurs in that midst? You know, it was my own journey, what I was going through, but I wanted to have documented proof, I guess you would say, of what was happening, what was occurring at different levels as a person came out of maybe of a Baptist church or Assembly of God and came into a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod church, for instance. So what transitions had to occur, what was going on, what were the struggles, what were the blessings, and so forth. And so I kind of ventured out knowing my journey, but I wanted to visit with other people as well, and that's kind of where the theses developed into.
Let's talk a little bit more about your journey. You said you did a colloquy, and for those of you who don't know what that is, if you're a pastor in another church body and you would like to become a pastor in the LCMS, if you fit a few certain requirements, like having a Master's of Divinity from an accredited seminary and so forth and so on, you can do this colloquy program, which brings you into the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. You may need a few classes to get up to speed on some theology that we believe or something like that. So anyway, from where did you colloquize, I guess, would be the question.
I was a part of a very small church denomination called the Church of Lutheran Brethren, about 110, 115 churches stateside, really heavy mission focus overseas, approximately, boy, if my memory serves me right, 1,400 to 1,500 churches over in Africa, church plants over there. And so I was actually baptized the old American Lutheran Church, but then I spent most of my life within the Church of Lutheran Brethren. And the way I like to describe the Lutheran Brethren, wonderful, dear friends in the Lutheran Brethren, and very grateful to them for you know, being baptized into that church and being taught, growing up in that church denomination. But that church, in a lot of ways, had a mixture of Lutheranism, mixed also with evangelicalism. I know it's been described, the Lutheran Brethren has been described as attempting to be Lutheran in theology, evangelical in practice. And so I kind of was a hodgepodge from that, where I had bits and pieces of Lutheranism, but I also had a lot of evangelicalism, a lot of, like I said, revivalism, the old revival tent meetings that was kind of in with that as well as a lot of the different practices and things that you would see, for instance, in Baptist churches or Assembly of God churches. And so kind of a mixed mutt, I guess you would say, as a result of that. And so, but it came out of that, and when I came to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, indeed I went through that colloquy process, and colloquy is basically a word that means conversation. So I started the conversation with the LCMS, and I was very upfront with them. I said, you know, when it comes to things such as the liturgy, I know absolutely nothing about the liturgy, had never practiced the liturgy. Obviously, my church had a different kind of liturgy, but as far as, you know, when it came to singing and chanting or the vestments, I didn't even know how to put a collar on, you know, or put vestments on or the alb, any of the colors up on the actually altar. I didn't know what that meant and so forth. So I had a real learning curve when it came to the liturgy and the practices of the church services in the LCMS. And then in regard to the history of the Lutheran Church in America from the perspective of the LCMS, I had to pick up and figure out what the history was And also some of the, I had some holes, I guess you would say, on the Book of Concord, trying to piece all that together. So those are three areas that they kind of pinpointed that I was lacking. And so I had to do some classes above and beyond the doctoral work I was doing, actually in St. Louis, some classes to kind of fill in those holes, I guess you would say. And then once those were all brought up to speed, then I was certified to be a pastor in the LCMS.
It sounds like that Lutheran Brethren experience that you had was kind of a good halfway house between evangelicalism and the LCMS. Would you say that that's a fair statement?
Yeah, I think that would be very fair. Almost trying to attempt to have a foot in both worlds. And so I kind of battled back and forth. In fact, you know, some of my theology, I guess, during that time would have been a mixture of, you know, some of the different tenets or beliefs that you would see within evangelicalism combined with Lutheranism, and trying to make them, mash them, and make them work together. And that's where I picked up, really, was through that church body, as well as the different people I rubbed shoulders with. I picked up a lot of different theological systems or theologies that are out there. And so, you know, if you were to visit with me back then, and you probably even to this day, I still have some of that stuff that kind of goes with me. I'd have different different movements and different things within Christianity that were definitely impacting me. You know, like you think about like Rick Warren's purpose-driven church, the church growth movement, the emergent church, which is Rob Bell and Brian McLaren. These were some real popular guys with the emergent church, and so. I did all that, the evangelism explosion, all that stuff. I'm very familiar with that, implemented that stuff, embraced it. The prayer Jabez was another one. Read that book, did that prayer. And so I had all that other noise, I kind of call it noise, that was mixed around that Lutheran theology. And so it was a process of sorting through and, you know, kicking some of those theologies out and then embracing the Lutheran theology as expressed in the Book of Concord. Coming into the LCMS.
How did you, you were saying that you were kind of a mutt growing up in various church bodies and whatnot. How did the Lutheran Confessions catch your attention?
Well, long story short, you know, I know in entering seminary, coming into seminary in the Lutheran Brethren, I really struggled, it would be very transparent here, I really struggled with the Lutheran theology. It was very offensive to me. It was actually very offensive to my old Adam, my sinful nature. The Lutheran theology basically saying that you're a poor, damned, miserable sinner and you can't do anything, that was very offensive. I thought, hey, man, I have potential. I can make decisions. I can decide to follow Jesus. I have all this potential, and I'm the master and commander of my spirituality. And the Lutheran theology, especially the doctrine of infant baptism, really was offensive to me. And so it was this kind of this love-hate relationship. It offended me, yet there was something so, oh boy, how would I say this, really it grabbed my attention. There was this assurance that I saw of those that were resting in this Lutheran theology, that they had this assurance. They were resting. They weren't fighting. They weren't working and climbing and trying to get to that next level. They were just content and operating in this rhythm of grace. And I found that to be very attractive. Maybe I can use that word, attractive. And as time went on, basically, I started to burn out my works righteousness, which I'm still, you know, plagued by works righteousness all the time. My old Adam clings to that. But what ended up happening is I just kind of started getting to the point where I just can't do it any longer. And even as a pastor, after I was ordained, still just go. I'm like, I just can't do it. And just getting to the point where I'm spiritually getting burnt out. And that actually sounds like it's bad, but it's actually the best thing that could have happened to me, is to spiritually burn out and realize I just can't do it. And I can just imagine the Lord finally saying, well, it's about time. You can do it, you dummy. I did it all for you. And so that's kind of what ended up pulling me towards the Lutheran Confessions, especially this fancy thing called the Heidelberg Disputation, which was written by Martin Luther. There were a bunch of theses talking about our works and the cross of Christ and how our works don't advance us any closer to the kingdom, but it's about the Lord Jesus Christ coming to us. And so that was just rich to me, and it was like a breath of fresh air into my soul.
What a fantastic thing the Heidelberg Disputation is and has been to me also. Pastor Charlie Hendrickson and I have done several weeks working through that on this program, and it speaks to me every time I go through it. It says so much more that's brand new and just really, really great. Like you, I tried the works righteousness route. I grew up with that, and I could not do it. I came to that place where I gave up on Christianity. I said, God hates me, and these Lutherans got a hold of me. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I really resonate with what you're talking about. Going on to this survey, this was your doctoral work here. What were some of the questions that you asked in the survey of people?
Well, really what happened is, you know, you have a thesis you have to start off with, you know, basically kind of identifying. And first thing I had to do was I was asserting that, hey, there's a difficult journey going from American evangelicalism to Lutheranism. And so I was asserting that, hey, this is not an easy jump to go from a Baptist or a Pentecostal church or a mainline non-denominational church, going from one of these churches into a confessional Lutheran liturgical church. That is not an easy jump. And so first thing I had to do was just prove and actually ask people that have actually made that journey, was it hard? And conclusively, the people that I interviewed came back. By the way, I was hoping to get 50 people to interview, and I ended up getting, it was over 300 participants. And I think all in all, I ended up getting over 700 surveys from these 300-some people filled out. So it was a phenomenal response. And from their voice, it was a collective voice, they basically said, yeah, it's a tough journey. It takes 1 to 4 years to work things through, to actually get into the point where you're saying, hey, I understand what's going on in this Lutheran church, and I'm going to, you know, commit to being going through catechesis and becoming a member of a Lutheran church. Now, with that said, I wanted to know what were the four, I identified four areas where there was concern. And I wanted to know what was happening in regard to their sources of knowledge. In other words, as you shifted from maybe a Baptist church or a Pentecostal church to the Lutheran church, was there a change in where you got your preaching, where you got your theology, what you read, what you actually listened to, and so forth? And that was the one area. And then the other area was I wanted to know, by changing in what they listened to and who they considered as authoritative, and as they came into Lutheranism, did they view things differently? Did they view themselves differently? How did they view the church? How did they view the world? Did that change? And then the other two I wanted to explore was the area of linguistics. Did you talk differently, basically, after you became a Lutheran? Did your words change? How did you accentuate certain things? How did your vocabulary adjust? And then finally, it was, what was going on emotionally? Was it good, you know, did they have good emotions coming to the Lutheran church? Were there bad emotions? Were there anger? Was there anger, or was there fear, and so forth? So those are kind of the four dimensions, what was going on with their knowledge, the way they viewed themselves, and their language, and their emotions.
That 1 to 4 years, I know for me it was almost 3 years that I fought and struggled, and I set out to disprove the Book of Concord and Mueller's dogmatics, and I lost. But that's interesting that you would say that, because in amongst my friends who are ex-evangelicals, that's about right, between 1 and 4 years. Why is that? Have you managed to figure that out?
Yeah, it was fairly consistent. Looking at the data, it was pretty consistent between 1 and 4 years. And I think the reason why it took so long is when it comes to these dimensions, like, for instance, that dimension of where you get your knowledge, that's actually a big fancy word called epistemology. It's the study of how we know and what we know and how we know it. And then the other level is a worldview. Maybe people have heard that word before. That's how we view the world and we view ourselves. And those two dimensions, I guess how we would say this, those two dimensions, they don't change easily. When they're challenged, when our worldviews are challenged, we usually put up a fight. When we listen to different sources of knowledge and they don't agree with us, we usually put up a real fight. We get angry. And so those are deep embedded frameworks in us as human beings. And anytime there's a change in those, it's very unsettling. You think about maybe a high school student going off to college. Oftentimes why it's so difficult for them going off to college is because they enter into a whole different realm. They have different authority figures speaking to them, different worldviews, and it can actually be earth-shattering for an individual. And so back to this, though, you're really having a shift in sources of knowledge and worldview, which they move slowly since they're so embedded. And you also have to keep in mind, many of these individuals have been 10, 15, 20 years within evangelicalism, and to jump into a whole new framework, that just doesn't happen overnight. That can take up to 1 to 4 years to make those transitions and make those changes. So that really is fundamentally at the basis of why it took so long, or takes so long, I guess you would say.
You talked about how baptism, especially infant baptism, was a stumbling block for you as you were investigating this. What are some of the most common stumbling blocks? I know baptism was for me also.
Yeah, baptism was. Communion was another one. Trying to think through this here. It boils down to this idea of free will. And that is fundamentally at the heart, the difference between having a free will and your will being bound. So I've used this example before within American evangelicalism, and this illustration is not original with me, but I love it. I steal it all the time. It's great. Basically, within American evangelicalism, we understand the will being free. In other words, we view ourselves as having like a stick to shift in a car. So we view ourselves being in neutral. We can either go forward or reverse. So it's just a matter of our will to choose whether or not to go forward or reverse. So reverse is bad and sin. Forward is righteousness and good. So it's just matter of fact of us putting it into forward. And if, you know, we're having problem, then we need to be encouraged and, you know, this pep talk, you know, get going. You better be on fire for Jesus. You better do a little bit more, dig a little deeper, and then you can put it in forward and you can do righteousness. The Lutheran Church has a different view of that, and I believe it is a scriptural view, and it views us basically having this car, and you look down, and there's actually no stick to shift, and there's just reverse. And so we're born in dead in trespasses and sin. We're going in reverse. There's no stick to shift. The doors are locked, and we need to be rescued from this car going backwards off of a cliff. And so, therefore, our predicament is much worse than it might, we first believe it to be. And that is why we need the gospel. That is why we need Christ to come and deliver us from this reverse car going off of a cliff. And so when we see something like infant baptism, you look at a child being completely helpless, a babe being saved. It is a picture, I guess you would say, a quintessential picture, the most perfect picture of God doing all the work. There's no work that the baby contributes. It just cries there in its diaper as the water is placed on the child and God pronounces his name on the child. And that's very offensive to that stick shift theology where we think we can engage and do it ourselves. And so infant baptism really, it pricks and it defends that theology of free will.
We're talking with Pastor Matthew Richard about his work that he's done on evangelical Christians and their journey into Lutheranism. And this is really, really fascinating stuff. I'm so glad that you have done this because you're talking about my experience, and it's really, really neat to see that you've put together quantifiable data and other things that really express so much of my life. And I think the lives of so many others that listen to this program and have been part of this program. We need to go ahead and take a break. But when we come back, we'll continue with Pastor Matthew Richard about this wonderful topic. Stay tuned. You're listening to Reformation Rush Hour on Worldwide KFUO. We'll be right back.
Worldwide KFUO during Share-a-thon 2015. Join us April 23rd, 24th, and 25th as we celebrate with some of your favorite on-air friends. Share-a-thon 2015 will be 3 days of fun and faith, along with an opportunity for you to show us your support. Remember to join us for Share-a-thon 2015, April 23rd through 25th. And please, prayerfully consider supporting Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Worldwide KFUO would like to invite you to start and end your day with prayer. At 9 a.m., join us for morning prayer as we look into the Word of God, we pray, and sing sacred music. At 6 p.m., we gather for evening prayer once again as we hear the Word of God, pray, and rejoice in His gift of music. Lift up your heart to heaven with Worldwide KFUO.
Reverend Dr. Matthew C. Harrison of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod recently said these words regarding the importance of the work of Concordia Historical Institute.
When you forget your past, you forget the gospel. You become locked into your own little part of time. As you study the past and know the past and know what happened in the past, you see God at work. And you see Christ.
Discover your Lutheran history at ConcordiaHistoricalInstitute.org.
It's okay if you miss a program on Worldwide KFUO because you can download them as a podcast at your convenience. There are so many programs at Worldwide KFUO that are centered on the gospel of Jesus Christ. Don't miss one of them. You can download one or all at KFUO.org or subscribe on iTunes. That's KFUO.org, the messenger of good news.
This is By the Way. Lord, I'm running very low on love these days. Can I get a refill? Perhaps you've had days when it seems unusually difficult to show love to those around you. Your patience runs out with the children and grandchildren. You're tired of the way your coworkers act. You want to give up on the world in which you live, so little hope for the future. You know that love is a powerful thing that can benefit those around you and even change you, but the tank is empty. Fortunately, God's supply of love is infinite. He has plenty, and He is always happy to give you a refill. Don't give up. Pray for understanding, peace of mind, and for the strength and the will to show love to yourself and to those around you. This is By the Way.
Listening to Reformation Rush Hour, the fastest hour in radio history, underway yet once again. One of my favorite bands in the world, the Sweet Hollywayans. No one knows about this stuff. I am so odd when it comes to music. Anyway, we are underwritten by ConcordiaHistoricalInstitute.org. Go discover your Lutheran history, all sorts of amazing historical artifacts and goodies over there. Great displays going on right now also in their museum, both at the seminary in St. Louis, if you happen to be in the area, go check it out. Papua New Guinea, the years and years that we've been doing missionary work over there, and there's art and all sorts of good stuff from Papua New Guinea. Also, here at the International Center of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, they have a wonderful display. Actually, many wonderful displays. You can see the carriage that CFW Walther rode in and all sorts of interesting and odd and wonderful things. So do check them out, ConcordiaHistoricalInstitute.org. And once again, be my friend on Facebook. Go find me. Go find Reformation Rush Hour, KFUO Radio. Go check out my blog, 200proofgospel.com, just the number 200. And with us also is Pastor Reverend Dr. Matthew Richard from Zion Lutheran Church in Gwinner, North Dakota. Your blog, Pastor?
Oh, it's pretty easy. It's PastorMattRichard.org or PastorMattRichard.com. Nice and original.
There you go. Or on Facebook, you can look up PM Notes also, right?
Yeah. And that's just a place where anytime I'm reading something cool, I copy and paste or type it right out there and just bless everyone else with it. So, yeah, it's underneath PM notes.
I find some of the most successful Facebook pages do nothing but that.
Yeah, not a whole lot original. I just take great stuff I read from other people, and I'm like, hey, I just pass it right on. I'm just one beggar showing the other people where the warm bread is. So
there you go.
Yep.
And that's good Lutheran language, too.
Yep.
That's good stuff. Anyway, we're talking about the work that you've done on American evangelicals becoming Lutheran. And I find it fascinating that you expected about 50 people to respond to your call for information. You got how many?
Yeah, I ended up having, it was over 300. And I ended up having, I ended up getting people from over in Europe wanting to participate too. And I just said, you know, I'm sorry, but I'll let you take the surveys. But I'm kind of keeping this just to North America. So all in all, it was close to 400 people. And it was quite amazing. I mean, it wasn't like, three, four questions for the surveys. The surveys took half hour, 45 minutes per survey. And I ended up having three of them. And so to actually have over 300 people taking, you know, literally hours upon hours, and boy, the amount of feedback I got, it was just binders and binders and binders of paper of feedback to go through. It was actually quite overwhelming and humbling to see that kind of, you know, positive feedback from people. So it's a very, very important subject to many individuals who made the journey into Lutheranism. So it's pretty cool to see.
Any thoughts about publishing this into a book?
Oh boy, you know, I've actually had a couple conversations with Concordia Publishing House, and boy, it's just basically finding the time to do it and the endurance to do it. So it is on my list. We'll have to see what the future brings as far as time-wise goes. And my wife is expecting our third, so maybe after baby gets a little bit older.
So. Never enough time to get everything done.
Oh, yeah. It's all good, though. All gifts, so.
It would be fascinating, and I'm sure not really that different, to see the responses that you would get from the Europeans who have become Lutheran versus the Americans. I think maybe because their culture is a little more on the liberal side, that might be some minor differences, but you imagine pretty much the same?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, I think fairly consistently you're going to have the same, you know, provided that they're coming from the same context. You know, when I defined in my research, I had to define what did I mean by American evangelicalism. And so I had to, boy, that was actually quite difficult, nailing down what is meant by American evangelicalism. And so I had to kind of draw the parameters. This is what I mean, and this is what I understand American evangelicalism to be. And so as long as they were coming from that same context and that they were journeying into the same definition of what we would define confessional Lutheranism by, I'm pretty certain that no matter where you're at, you're going to experience some of those same transitions because you're leaving something similar and going to something else very quite similar too as well.
We were talking a little bit on the first half about justification by grace through faith alone, not by works. And how our old Adam always wants to interject our works into Christianity. And so this, as you were saying, affects our view of baptism. It also affects our views of the Lord's Supper and absolution and so many other things. That idea that that our consciences are bound. And Martin Luther wrote a wonderful book on that, The Bondage of the Will. How much does that impede people from coming into the Lutheran Church?
I think fundamentally, at the heart of it, that is the crux. I mean, that is the climax. That is the you see that throughout all of the theology. For instance, to give you an example, I used to say on Sunday mornings, "Let's go to worship the Lord," which we do worship the Lord, but my intent and purpose was to go to church and to give my best to God, because God was the audience and I was the speaker. But when you understand that mankind is dead in sin, and we come into church, and you think about the Lutheran church, right from the get-go, I mean, we offend everyone, right from the get-go in the Lutheran divine service, the first thing we do, we say, "I, a poor, miserable sinner." right away, we admit that we are dead in our sins, and the pastor pronounces the absolution, and the rest of the service is all about the divine, the Lord, serving us. And so Without that bound will theology, we go to church to give our best to God and to direct our speaking efforts to Him as the audience. But when you look at the Lutheran service, the Lutheran divine service, we're the audience. God is speaking to us, and He's delivering His goods and His best to us. So it completely inverts everything. And so we see that in the divine service. We see that in our view of infant baptism. We see that in evangelism. We see that in preaching across the board. Two fundamental ways of looking at things, truly, when it comes to that idea of our wills.
One of the other things, and going along with this whole topic of sin and grace and God at work alone in this, one of the things that I recall that once this fell into place for me, the whole thing seemed to come together, was that understanding that we are saints and sinners at the same time. There's a reading in the evangelical world of Romans 7 when Paul says that good stuff that I want to do, I don't do that. And the evil stuff that I hate, I keep doing that and I can't seem to help myself. But in the Lutheran Church, we understand that you are not either a saint or a sinner, but you are both simultaneously. Is this something that popped up much on your survey?
Yeah, I'm trying. Just thinking about it, really kind of in the realms of sanctification, and also in how we talked about baptism without understanding the simultaneously sinner and saint. What ends up happening is we kind of chronologically look at it as I was a sinner, past tense, and then now I am a saint, rather than saying, you know, I was a sinner, now I am a what? Simultaneously a sinner and saint. And so what ends up happening is that if we go the other route of saying that I was a sinner, past tense, and we take Romans 7 and we say, hey, that was Paul before he became a Christian, then what we end up doing is we end up diminishing this doctrine of original sin and its consequences. And that was very, very prevalent within American evangelicalism. And so many individuals, when they came into Lutheranism, they, across the board, they said, you know, Lutherans have a much more robust theology of sin. It's much more realistic. It calls a spade a spade. And inadvertently, when you see yourself as a sinner, you know, through and through, because we're simultaneously sinner and saint, when we understand our depravity, that we are truly poor, miserable sinners, then it just makes that gospel so much better. I mean, it's like, oh my goodness, He died for me, the wretch, you know, and He claimed me, and He declares me a saint, pure grace, pure gift, and He looks at me and says to me, in Christ, I am well pleased with you. Wow, you know, that excitement that I have in my voice right now is the excitement that I heard in these surveys of people coming through saying, hey, the doctrine of sin is much more strong within Lutheranism, but also the gospel, of Christ, of the forgiveness of sins, is even stronger. And so we definitely saw that in the transition.
I remember Dr. Rod Rosenblatt just grinding into me that even in the midst of my sinning, Jesus is there with His grace, forgiving me, redeeming me, being my Savior, even when I'm basically spiritually sticking my middle finger out at Him. And what a liberating thing that is to realize. And of course, unfortunately, for some of us, we like to try to put that to the test a little bit. We call it antinomianism, lawlessness. And I always like to say you can't out-sin God's grace, but boy, can you poke your eye out in the process of checking that out. But did you come across anyone who spoke about testing the limits of this newfound grace?
Yeah. One thing to keep in mind, the study I actually did, when I did my theses, one of the things that they have you do is at the very beginning, you have to define your parameters. In other words, you define, hey, this is what I'm going to study. This is the area I'm going to study. And then you also have to define some of your presuppositions. You're assuming. So I'm assuming this, 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 and I'm only going to study, within this boundary. And so with my doctoral thesis, my parameters were basically looking at those individuals who were saying, hey, what's up with this Lutheranism? I want to learn more. So I studied from that person all the way to the person who just got catechized and became a member of the Lutheran Church. And so within that parameter, what I mainly saw with those individuals, there was a hesitancy mainly with them saying, is this too good to be true? is this gospel really this free? Is it really this sweet? In fact, there was a certain amount of fear that they experienced, wondering if, you know, is there a catch? Is there a catch 22? I mean, am I going to get in the Lutheran church, and then all of a sudden I'm going to say, oh, bam, we got you. You know, we told you it was free, but now here's a list of rules. You know, so I didn't really, see the opposite, or not the opposite, but what happened further down the road. But in my conversations with individuals after coming to the Lutheran church and being in the Lutheran church, I think it's quite realistic or reasonable to say that individuals flirt with that antinomianism. I know for myself, I started dipping my toes in it, saying, "You know, where does this end? Where's the other side to this?" You know, most evangelicals have lived in that legalism, that self-righteousness, that absolutely ties one up in knots and binds one up with a lack of assurance. But then, you know, get into that Lutheranism and get into that gospel, which is free gift. You know, what's the other side? And so I think it's reasonable to say, but I don't have any documented proof of individuals going and dipping their toes in that antinomianism.
When I became a Lutheran, my value of church changed dramatically. Growing up in evangelicalism, it was always me and Jesus, you know, and I can worship listening to a sermon on the radio or watching some Christian television or whatever, all that, you know, is quote-unquote worship. But once I became a Lutheran, I discovered that church was a lot more important, and it wasn't just me and Jesus. It was me, you, us, and Jesus, And also this new doctrine that I learned called the doctrine of vocation. Are these things that have popped up on your radar? And if so, are there any good stories from the surveys that you heard or read on this?
You know, when it comes to the doctrine of vocation, I think that didn't really hit the radar tremendously. I think you got to keep in mind, like I said before, I think there are some of these things that kind of maybe come out as time goes on. At once, that doctrine of justification sets in, once the divine service sets in, that doctrine of vocation flows out of that, I guess you would say. So that wasn't, you know, substantially on the radar. One thing that, though, individuals did mention was that in going from evangelicalism to Lutheranism, there's much more of a use of the plural of us, our. There's a pluralness of the body of Christ gathering together corporately. And I know even for myself, coming into the Lutheran church, being able to voice together, to confess the faith together, for instance, in the Nicene Creed or the Apostles' Creed, I'm just overwhelmed every Sunday, you know, when I look to my congregation and I say, you know, with one heart and one voice, let us confess the one holy faith as expressed in the Apostles' Creed. And then everyone waits, and then I say, I believe, and everyone standing up, say, you know, it's a joint confession of this is what we believe together as we stand, you know, boldly confessing the Christ who is for us. And so I've been overwhelmed by that aspect, just personally speaking, as a pastor. And I'm not sure if my church even knows how grateful I am for that. It's just phenomenal. But there's definitely some linguistic changes that came about, you know, with the individuals in coming into the Lutheran church as well, in regard to the language that was used, for instance, like I said, the more of the use of the plural, or the understanding of the pluralness of the body, of that this is our church, that we are together, that we stand side by side, and that this is our confession of faith together.
For those who have come to the Lutheran church from evangelicalism, what kind of emotions do these people experience? Is it anger, fear, resentment, regret? What sorts of things have people talked about with you?
Yeah, that was actually quite interesting to see. In fact, I picked up on a pretty interesting trend, and I didn't catch it at first, but what I ended up doing is, since I had so much data, I organized a group of individuals, about a dozen people. I had some individuals from the Baptist Church, some from Faith Alliance, you know, male, female pastors, so forth. And they actually came and they helped me analyze the data to help ensure objectivity And one of the things that we picked up on that we noticed is that individuals who decided to stay in their evangelical churches, in other words, they said, you know what, I want to know more about this Lutheran doctrine, the Book of Concord, but before I fully commit and jump into it, I'm going to stay in my evangelical church, and I'm maybe just going to listen to Reformation Rush Hour, going to listen to Issues, etc., going to listen to all these shows, I'm going to read my Book of Concord, I'm going to start reading and understanding this stuff. They actually got very angry. They about partway through the journey, they got very resentful, very frustrated in their evangelical churches. Whereas conversely, those that said, you know what, I like what I'm seeing, what I'm hearing, it makes sense. And they say, you know, I don't have it all quite figured out, but I'm going to jump in head first, going to get catechized, and I'm going to just, you know, figure it out when I'm in the Lutheran church. They actually expressed more hope and joy than those that actually remained in the evangelical church and tried to work it out themselves, which was quite fascinating to see.
What's funny as I hear you talking is that I think I experienced anger at my past, but also I was a little angry at the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod because they had this wonderful good news of Jesus Christ, and they weren't standing on the rooftops screaming this stuff. Why is it so hard to find this? And I think part of it is you have to be prepared for it. You have to really be to a place of despair of yourself and your own goodness before you can really start to wrap your arms around the goodness of this gospel. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. You know, it, quite a few thoughts. I'm trying to figure out where to start. The first is what was actually happening, you know, when people came in fact, I'm actually trying to pull it up on my computer right now, maybe doing a little bit of stalling here. I actually compiled a letter, you know, from the voices of all these survey results, and I compiled a letter that they had actually wrote to a confessional Lutheran pastor. And basically, it's a kind of a rebuke from these former evangelicals coming to Lutheranism, basically telling their pastors, their new Lutheran pastors, to remain steadfast, not to buckle, to not waver and not water it down. And so what you see is these you know, new Lutherans coming in, they're fired up and they're excited about this theology. But like what you said there too, there's also with some of the survey results that I received, people were actually quite, they had to work through anger, kind of maybe almost an embarrassment that they believed what they did for so many years, that they believed some of the false theologies that they had bought so much in hook, line, and sinker. And so there was a sense of shame, a sense of frustration. I know for myself, you know, I think about all the books that I bought and all the energy and the time that I spent doing some of this church growth stuff. And really all that it was denying the means of grace, the stuff that I invested in. So there's a sense of shame, a sense of frustration, thinking about the time and energy that was put in. But it also provides an opportunity for confession, confession of sin, and then to hear absolution as one works through that. So, yeah, a lot of emotions that were going through, good, bad, positive, anger, fear, excitement, joy, going through this whole process.
Boy, I can't begin to tell you, and maybe this is kind of an overshare, but what the heck, that's what I do. When I first became a Lutheran, it was by the confessions, and I joined this church because my friends were joining it also and this sort of thing. And shortly after we got there, they started trying to import all of the contemporary music and this sort of thing. And I remember fighting with a pastor for over a year saying, look, I came from that garbage. I don't want to go back to that. You're heading to where I came from. He said, well, let me tell you about your generation. Your generation wants this stuff. I am my generation. I don't want this
stuff.
Right. But yeah, I totally resonate with what you're saying there, that those of us who have come from the outside understand what it is to roam in the wilderness for 40 years and finally come into the promised land. And I'm a little hard on lifelong Lutherans because I see them as children who have grown up in the promised land. And so many of them, not all of them, but so many of them look out in the wilderness and they say, isn't the desert beautiful?
Yeah.
What are some of the other things? We just have about 2 minutes left. Anything else that really jumped out at you as you did this survey?
You know, one of the most phenomenal things, a couple things here, just to briefly hit two of them here. It was quite phenomenal to see that once individuals came into Lutheranism, the sources that they read, they said, you know, we went from reading people in the top 10 charts on the Christian bookstores, but when we came to Lutheranism, we started reading a bunch of dead guys, which I think is awesome. And so they started looking to those of the faith that came way before. They weren't so immediately willing to jump on and read, you know, any book that was just supposedly the best top 10 or the most profound thing out there. So people started becoming much more discerning once they came to Lutheranism and reading a lot more people that were dead rather than alive, which I found that to be kind of, you know, A, humorous, and B, very insightful to see. But the other thing, though, too, is in the language that, generally speaking, when the people came in, the respondents, when they came into Lutheranism, there was a diminishing of their directional phrases and feeling phrases. They didn't talk about feeling phrases or phrases that inclined one to move directionally.
What do you mean by that, directional language?
Yeah, like to move deeper or further or more. It was more baptismal language. Either, you know, you're not or you are. And so, in other words, I am baptized. It's not the language of you need to fall further in love with Jesus or you need to go deeper into his love. It's no, I'm baptized, period. And it's also the language they found. The language was much more passive. It was the Lord doing the verbs to them rather than them always doing the verbs toward the Lord. And so it was a much less use of I need to move further or deeper or closer to the Lord. It was always about the Lord coming to us and forgiving, baptizing, cleansing, you know, not directional or not movement language, but indicative, we would say, absolute certain statements of what he does for us. So that was phenomenal to see as well, as far as their language.
It's that language of what we call extranos from the outside.
Right, absolutely, yep.
Understanding that Christ comes to us, we don't go to him.
Right.
And of course, in evangelicalism, in Roman Catholicism, in so many other church bodies, it's all about us reaching up to God, either through the Lord's Supper, representing Jesus to the Father once again as a bloodless sacrifice, or representing ourselves as some sort of propitiation for our sins or something like that. But we never manage to get it right on our own.
Right.
And we can never do it sincere enough or right enough. Pastor Matthew Richard, thanks so much for being with us today on Reformation Rush Hour.
Hey, it was wonderful. A lot of fun, too.
God bless you, my brother.
You too.
We hope to have you back again sometime real soon. I just want to remind you also that coming up next week is the KFUO Share-a-thon. And Thursday, Friday, Saturday, we'll be having the Share-a-thon. Please do tune into that and consider being a day sponsor and a supporter of Worldwide KFUO. We are listener supported and we depend on your gifts to keep this program and so many others going. Until next time, may the Lord bless you and keep you in his grace to life everlasting. We'll see you.